Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie, and I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel on December 3rd. Crime and punishment and Zoom logins. Local judge prepares for the first virtual trial in West Texas by Stephen Paulson. Tri-County. Judge Roy Ferguson is sitting in his courtroom in the Jeff Davis County Courthouse, or so it would seem. Then the judge adjusts the background on his Zoom call, summoning first a promotional image for the hit Netflix series Tiger King, then stock video of a tropical beach. As waves lap behind him, Ferguson, who judges for five counties in West Texas, including the Tri-County, explains that he's actually in his courthouse office in Alpine. But there's a message in the changing scenery behind him. If judges and lawyers want the public to take virtual court seriously, they need to take it seriously themselves. I've always got some sort of background on to make it clear that this is a courtroom, Ferguson says. He's also got many of the same rules from his pre-pandemic and in-person courtroom days. No hats, no smoking, no chewing gum. By contrast, there have been courtrooms where you couldn't tell who the judge was, Ferguson says. Sometimes the judge is the worst-dressed person in the Zoom. Ferguson thinks it's part of his role as a judge to set the tone of court hearings, whether they're happening in the majesty of a courtroom or via computers. He credits that philosophy with keeping his virtual courts mostly free of tomfoolery, although there have been exceptions, including one person who tried to attend court while driving and another who logged into a hearing from bed. 9 months into a coronavirus pandemic, it'll come as no surprise to Big Bend residents that coronavirus is upending and changing the patterns of daily life. In the court system, those changes have been stark. Since the pandemic began this year, Texas courts have held more than 760,000 virtual hearings, summoning millions of people to millions of hours of mandatory on-screen court business. These shifts have altered procedures that, until this year, were basically always done in person, from cross-examining witnesses to gathering large groups of people for bond hearings or jury selection. In Texas, few have had to grapple with the disruptions of coronavirus in courts quite like Judge Ferguson. Back in March, he became the first on-call quarantine judge in the state, tasked with enforcing control orders from health officials and public officials. Ferguson worried the role, which would have seen him constantly traveling to different quarantine hearings across the state, would be impossible to do effectively in person. He brought those concerns up with the Texas Office of Court Administration, which Ferguson says quickly put out guidance on remote hearings. Texas was an early adopter of those and other pandemic-era safety practices and later guided the way for other states. Ferguson has conducted his own court business virtually since March. Now he's getting ready for another milestone, the first virtual jury trial in West Texas. Ferguson is always reticent to discuss cases before him, and he didn't want to give details on the trial, which starts later this month. But he did say it was a civil case, not a criminal trial. One of the people involved in the case is elderly, and the lawyers were interested in doing a virtual trial. That worked for Ferguson, who himself isn't much interested in in-person court hearings these days. Technically, and despite coronavirus restrictions on gatherings, Ferguson says he absolutely still has the power to compel people to physically come to court. But with cases spiking in the region, he says there's a real possibility that a defendant, lawyer, or prospective juror with COVID-19 could inadvertently infect others. I'm not going to force someone to come to court and potentially kill someone, he said. I'm not going to do it, and I don't have to do it. Holding a virtual jury trial comes with its own quirks. Instead of in-person interviews, prospective jurors will fill out an online form asking them basic questions, like whether they know anyone involved in the trial. The second pool of jurors will use a similar questionnaire for voir dire, the questioning process by which lawyers on either side of a case eliminate potential jurors. When a final juror pool is selected, the court will then issue identical iPads for them to log into the Zoom trial. The iPads won't have social media apps, but will have cameras, which Ferguson says jurors will have to keep on. That will allow Ferguson to keep an eye on jurors throughout the trial and make sure no rules are being broken. Way back in April, Ferguson was asked if he'd be willing to do a virtual trial. He declined, worried that he wouldn't be able to conduct a high-stakes court proceeding over a computer screen. I don't want to be a circus, he said, explaining his thinking at the time. I'm not going to let something be a mockery. I want to make sure what could happen, what the risks were, what to expect. But Ferguson warmed to the idea of virtual trials for a few reasons. For one, there have now been thousands of virtual court hearings and at least two official verdict trials in Texas, including one for a speeding ticket near Houston. After watching the processes like these, virtual trials started to feel like less of an unknown. For another, as the coronavirus pandemic enters its 10th month, Ferguson has grown increasingly concerned about the prospect of backlogs and delayed trials nationwide. Though he says he stayed on top of his own cases, it should weigh on everyone in the system when justice is delayed, he said. There's the famous quote, "Justice delayed is justice denied." Ferguson brings up the example of a defendant who was charged in a crime but wasn't able to make bail. Technically, he points out, that person is still innocent. Some law enforcement agencies have adopted compassionate release policies to keep people from waiting in jails for trial during a pandemic. But Ferguson worries about other cases where people are still sitting in jail with no conviction or otherwise having their life upended by a still pending charge. Last but not least, Ferguson says many of the worries about virtual courts just haven't come to pass. At first, many worried, fairly, that people might cheat in virtual court. Defendants could intimidate witnesses, or jurors could read news stories about a crime on their phone. But people cheat in person too, Ferguson said. While jurors in the pre-pandemic days may have been watched closely in court, they could still feasibly go home and Google the case which they were serving. So Ferguson watched and presided over more virtual hearings. He grew increasingly confident that they could provide the same standards and security as in-person court. Anyone who thinks that's a new problem, he said, hasn't been working hard enough to protect the sanctity of their jury trials before the pandemic. If anything, Ferguson says, virtual trials can offer a better experience to the public, including defendants. People who so far attended virtual hearings have had overwhelmingly positive experiences, according to a survey conducted by the National Center for State Courts in June. More than 90% said they had no issues talking to clients during hearings, while less than 5% thought that holding court hearings virtually rather than in person had altered conduct of any participant. In the pre-pandemic times, someone with a court date in Alpine may have had to drive from Terlingua or Marathon, or they might even live out of state and need to figure out trips all the way from California or Florida. With those issues now gone, Ferguson said more people are showing up to court, including not just defendants, but interested parties in other types of cases like child custody hearings. It's easier for people to get lawyers, he says, because they don't have to pay a Dallas lawyer to travel out to the Big Bend. And the whole court process goes faster, in part because judges aren't as incentivized to do cattle call dockets, where they summon a group of defendants in the morning to make sure no one misses their court hearings. You don't have to log in at 9 a.m. to have a hearing at 4, Ferguson explained. You can log in at 3:50. For Ferguson, who served on the local bench since 2012, these look like improvements, not pandemic-era glitches. He hopes that some of these new protocols are here to stay, though he acknowledges that, outside of emergencies, it would take lawmakers to change them. We've learned enough to know that we can deliver high-quality justice in this format, Ferguson said. People are satisfied. People like the fact that they're served better by the justice system. It's a much more user-friendly format. It's great when someone's concern with the problem is the inverse of what happens, he added. And when it comes to virtual trials, all of those fears aren't proving true. In fact, the opposite is proving true. Explosive COVID Tourism and the Future of Testing in the Big Bend by Abby Perot, December 2nd, 2020. Far West Texas. As the Big Bend region winds down from a busy Thanksgiving holiday week, County Health Authority Dr. John Paul J.P. Schwartz predicts another big surge of coronavirus cases is coming as the effects of local gatherings start appearing in local data. Even before the holiday, the final round of military-run testing sites revealed the county's highest spike in coronavirus cases yet. But nailing down the cause of the current explosive spread is neither simple nor easy. Over the weekend, some officials and residents in the Big Bend region were stunned to learn Presidio County ranked third highest in the country for recent coronavirus cases per capita, according to data tracked by the New York Times. Brewster County was right behind, coming in fourth among every county in the United States. In the past week alone, Presidio County saw 85 cases added. Brewster County saw 239 new cases, and Marfa recorded its first COVID-19 death. Dr. Schwartz was less surprised. The winter spike he had predicted was coming to pass. The increase in coronavirus cases had gone up exponentially, and it's going to continue, he explained this week. Attempting to put the large numbers into perspective, he said, when you realize every time you pass 20 strangers on the street, one on average has COVID, that hits home a little more. Meanwhile, some residents are increasingly concerned that tourism in the area is exacerbating the spread of the disease, as the area has continued to rely on visitors to buoy its economy. Signs posted around town this week offered cutting words to visitors, sending messages like, "Tourism kills," "Everyone here hates you," and "This town chooses your dollars over the safety of the people that live here, so make sure you get a tote bag." But through tracing efforts at the city level, Don Culbertson, a contact tracer for the city of Marfa and a physician assistant at the Marfa Clinic, said he has no proof that tourism is a big contributor to the COVID spreading through the region. It's easy to vilify tourists and say people walking around town are spreaders, and that's the problem. But I don't have any proof of that, Culbertson said in an interview Wednesday. We all have judgment about seeing people here during our pandemic, but I don't know. County Judge Cinderella Guevara also cast doubt on the role of tourism in the explosion of COVID cases in the area. In the whole 8 months of coronavirus, I've never heard anyone say, "I know I got that case from visitors that came here," she said. "I'm not saying it doesn't exist or that it hasn't happened, but I've just never heard of it." Instead of tourists, Culbertson turned his attention to another culprit. "I think a lot of our transmission is happening between each other," Culbertson said. "We don't mix with tourists that much, and we live in multi-generational communities. While it's true that a young person could bring home the virus from their service industry job and infect a grandparent," he said, "more transmission is likely occurring from locals making trips to the larger surrounding cities and bringing it back home. I'm seeing clusters in the workplace. I'm seeing clusters in family units. And sometimes I'm seeing clusters in businesses like bars and hotels," Culbertson said. But he didn't want to pin blame on large gatherings, stating that the town hardly ever has any. "We don't have a bowling alley, a movie theater, or restaurants wide open. The churches are adapting, spreading out, and distancing," he added. "So I really think people are transmitting it through social interactions, family interactions, and workplace interactions. In Marfa, we don't have a mass gathering spot, but we have micro-gathering spots," Culbertson said. "Maybe that's what makes Marfa unique." Judge Guevara believes the spread is the result of a small proportion of COVID-positive individuals who aren't taking proper precautions. "When I see the list of new cases, I'm like, I just saw this person last night at Stripes," the judge said. "I'm fearful for people because I think I see too many people not taking it seriously." Still, Culbertson did not entirely write off the possibility of locals getting COVID from outside tourists. Recently, though, he's traced some cases where it's possible tourists have contracted COVID-19 from locals during their Marfa stays. "I've walked down the street in Marfa and gone into super crowded shops in Marfa just to observe. I've seen a high concentration of people and I don't recognize them," he said. "The tourists are here and the mixing of people is not healthy," he said. "We've already been told by CDC and experts that moving around and mixing in hotels and restaurants isn't good for us." Tracing has become a key role in understanding local COVID spread, but much of it relies on individuals getting tested and finding out their test is positive. While larger cities in Texas are able to rely on a wide variety of testing options at hospitals, minute clinics, doctor offices, local government-run testing, and more, Big Bend residents have so far gotten the majority of their COVID tests taken at state-run mobile clinics where military testing teams popped up day-long events and tested any individual who wanted to be, regardless of symptoms or insurance status, and all at zero cost to the patient. But last month, local emergency management coordinator EMC Gary Mitchka announced that the testing sites run by the Texas National Guard and coordinated by the Texas Division of Emergency Management would be going away with no concrete plans for their return. In an email to EMCs and county judges, TDEM District Coordinator Al Talavera informed officials that a private vendor, Curative Inc., would be releasing a fleet of mobile testing vans, that a couple of those could be secured for the region. "The catch," Talavera wrote, "is that these vans will not be state-sponsored sites. The arrangement will be between Curative and the local jurisdiction. The vans will be insurance-based testing that will set up a location determined by local officials. Citizens will walk up to the location and get a mouth swab test. If the individual has insurance, the insurance will be charged. If they do not, the test will be paid out of a national fund, Talavera explained. Regardless, he wrote, there would be no out-of-pocket cost to the individual. The coordinator urged Tri-County officials to coordinate dates together so that the vans would be able to move through Presidio, Brewster, and Jeff Davis counties in one window of time. Curative did not respond to requests for comment on their role or timeline in potentially bringing testing vans to West Texas. But Talavera concluded his message by writing that the vans could set up for a day, a few days, or as long as the jurisdiction needs them, at least until federal funding goes away. While Michka was glad to learn of new testing coming to the area, he doubted whether the testing vans would be capable of meeting the same capacity as the military operations, which were able to test over 1,000 Presidio County residents in 2 days on their last local stop. On Wednesday, TDEM told Courthouse News reporter Travis Bubinick that new mobile COVID testing would be deployed to rural West Texas next week, adding, nobody should see a change in the effectiveness of how the operation runs. As Presidio and Brewster counties remain some of the hottest spots in the country at press time, Schwartz said that if it was up to local governments, they would be calling another lockdown to try and shut down the spread. As it stands, though, local officials' hands are tied by the governor's orders, which limit local officials from enforcing anything stricter than what the governor has mandated. Schwartz has called the governor's rules, like 50% capacity at establishments, the most meaningless gesture. You can see it's gotten us where we are now. In neighboring El Paso County, Judge Ricardo Samaniego tried to fly in the face of the state and institute a lockdown, but he was met with hostility, threats of a lawsuit, and personal attacks from Attorney General Ken Paxton, who put out a news release calling Samaniego a tyrant. Perhaps with that in mind, on Monday, Judge Guevara issued a press release that explained, Presidio County is rated number one in Texas for having the most cases per capita in the state, and that the increase represents a positive 1,094% change over a 14-day period. But rather than mandating new restrictions, which she has limited power to do, Guevara instead said county officials were encouraging all residents to shelter in place as much as possible and to avoid all non-essential travel. Speaking on the drastic rise of cases in the Big Bend in a phone interview this week, Guevara pleaded directly to residents. It's really scary, she said, and this is the time to bear down and be patient. We are all tired of it and all frustrated with it, but at the same time, we just have to fight, especially for the ones that we love. Martha's newest bookstore brings variety and a little innovation to book shopping. By Abby Perot. Martha. Since opening its doors on Sunday, Stop and Read has nearly sold out of all its cookbooks. Martha's newest bookstore, a project of Marfa resident Kendall Weir, is offering a wide variety of books with the aim of inclusion and a bit of innovation, too. Weir herself has been digging into more cookbooks lately. I'm trying to be a better at-home cook since I no longer eat out at restaurants, she says, referencing her penchant for avoiding crowds during this year's coronavirus pandemic. Along with the new interest in cookbooks, Weir loves fiction, short essays, and personal memoirs, but currently she prefers anything light, she says with a laugh. Her shop offers more than just her personal taste, though. A peek through its tall glass windows on San Antonio Street reveals a bright and colorful array of books against all white walls and shelving. The shop has a whole wall of books for children, shelves for young adults, and adult readers alike, popular titles and books for poetry fans, or the aspiring green thumb. We're definitely not a niche bookstore, Weir says from the perch of her shop stool this week. When Weir arrived in Marfa from Philadelphia in March of 2017, she wasn't looking for work. Like many more recent Marfa transplants, Weir had a remote job allowing her to move anywhere. She was working in the field of experiential marketing from then all the way until COVID-19 hit. The job was really based on the ability for people to gather, she says. And when people can't gather, that sort of renders that industry underwater. When she got laid off during the pandemic, Weir didn't feel like she was going to find a comparable job while still being able to remain in Marfa. So she'd have to make her own employment if she wanted to stay. I found it much more peaceful to be living here than in the city, so she became determined to find a way. Fortunately, Weir already found an inkling of an idea to open a business centered around books. A year and a half before coronavirus hit, she was thinking about ways to create a book service, she had the rough concept, a subscription service that's curated by artists every month. At the time, I had a full-time job and it didn't seem feasible, she said. But suddenly, as 2020 took hold, things were falling into place. The chance to rent a spot in Britt Webb's old service station fell into her lap and inspired her service station-esque business name. Weir calls the business her pandemic pivot, something many workers across the United States are considering as certain industries have been decimated during the prolonged national economic sputter. Brick-and-mortar shops have struggled to compete with online sales during the pandemic, but Weir has an answer for that, too. The new business owner is ready to meet customers not only in her San Antonio street shop, but online. I have a really heavy digital strategy, she says, something that can be credited to her marketing background. Our subscription service is a monthly service curated by artists all across all mediums. So in each subscription, you'll get exposure to an artist that you may have heard of or maybe you have not. They'll pick two books for you, and there will be some sort of limited edition collaboration to every box, she explains. You'll also have access to an online forum to have book discussions since it's COVID world, and you're not really safe to have any public book clubs at this time. And you'll get an Ask Me Anything with the artist every month, where you can ask about the book, them, their process. The subscription service will launch early next year, and Weir hopes that it will reach readers far and wide and expose them to artists in many mediums. She's already lined up an illustrator from Austin, an indie musician, and a drag queen to curate the monthly book box. I was very much the kind of child who would get in trouble every night because I'd be under the covers with a flashlight and my mom would come to the room and pull the flashlight and the book away and say, "You have to stop reading." Weir said she already has young adults requesting books of their own and hopes to partner with local schools in the future and to launch a children's story hour outside the shop during warm weather months. To bolster her inclusionary ethos, she's added a used book section with the aim of making reading accessible to everyone at a much lower price point and has a slew of Spanish language titles headed to the shop. I'm really looking forward to fill the need the community asked for, she says. And yes, she takes requests. Visit www.stopandreadbooks.com or stop by 317 West San Antonio Street from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. most days.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, November 26th. Front page. Additional COVID-19 death reported. PCMH reached full capacity last week. By Nathan Hewer, Pioneer editor. The COVID-19 related death total increased to 23 on Tuesday, November 24th, in Pecos County, when a 58-year-old passed away after testing positive for the coronavirus on November 7th. The individual was hospitalized at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa before his passing. Active case numbers continued to stabilize in the 40s and 50s for the county. Since November 16th, the number of active cases has stayed between 48 and 59. The county's peak active case number was at 67 people on November 2nd. As of November 23rd, there were 59 active cases in Pecos County and 6 hospitalizations at Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The facility has a capacity for 9 COVID-19 patients in the COVID-19 designated hall. At the Pecos County Commissioners Court meeting on November 23rd, PCMH CEO Betsy Briscoe updated the COVID-19 status at the hospital, saying the capacity COVID-19 patients at PCMH went past full capacity over the past week. On Thursday night into Friday morning, there were 10 patients hospitalized who had tested positive for COVID-19. That forced the hospital to move one of the patients to another hall that had negative air pressure rooms so the virus won't spread. According to Briscoe, the hospital received a donation in recent time to convert 2 additional rooms to negative pressure in another hall to allow for more COVID-19 patients. PCMH will also be receiving a new type of rapid test in December that not only tests for COVID-19, but would also test for flu A, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and strep. As for overall numbers in the county, there have been 3,015 tests administered since the start of the pandemic. Of those 3,015 tests, 2,305 tests have come back negative, 76%. There are 69 tests pending as of November 23rd and 519 positive tests since the start of the pandemic. A total of 436 people have recovered after testing positive in Pecos County. There has been 24 recoveries from November 18th to November 23rd. PCMH receives grant for vaccine freezer by Nathan Hewer, Pioneer Editor. Initial stages of preparation for COVID-19 vaccines have begun in Pecos County. On Monday, November 23rd, at the Pecos County Commissioner's Court regular meeting, it was announced that Pecos County Memorial Hospital was awarded an emergency grant of $15,000 from the FMH Foundation for an ultra-low freezer for COVID-19 vaccines and associated costs. It was reported at the meeting that the freezer is estimated to be around $12,000. The commissioners approved the grant with a unanimous vote. PCMH CEO Betsy Briscoe stated that the freezer will reach 60 to 80 degrees below zero, the temperature required to store the first batch of vaccines that will be released at some point in 2021. The delivery date of the freezer is unknown at this time. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster added that he was on a conference call on Friday, November 20th, with Briscoe, head nurse of PCMH, and Jesse Dominguez, emergency management coordinator in Pecos County, with a pair of doctors that are on a committee that gives advice to the governor of Texas. The judge went on to say that the state does not yet know when vaccines will become available, but one vaccine has been turned into the FDA for approval already. Additionally, there are two other vaccines awaiting in the wings, according to Schuster. The likely order of people to receive vaccines is first responders and those on the front lines battling the virus, then the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions, such as diabetes and heart conditions. DSHS orders 50 capacity for indoor facilities. Hospitals to discontinue elective surgeries. By Nathan Hewer. On Monday, November 23rd, the Texas Department of State Health Services sent a letter to Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster stating Pecos County is ordered to return to 50% capacity for the following: restaurants, retail stores, office buildings, manufacturing facilities, gyms and exercise facilities and classes, museums and libraries. The order is due to having a hospitalization rate in the trauma service area of over 15% over a period of 7 consecutive days. Additionally, licensed hospitals in the Trauma Service Area J are required to discontinue elective surgeries as set forth in Executive Order GA-31. The order can be removed if the hospitalization rate in the area stays below 15% for 7 consecutive days. The letter sent to Schuster stated the following: on Wednesday, October 7th, 2020, Governor Abbott issued Executive Order GA-32, which superseded GA-30. Significantly, GA-32 updates the thresholds for areas with high hospitalizations. The new definition of areas with high hospitalizations is any trauma service area that has had 7 consecutive days in which the number of COVID-19 hospitalized patients as a percentage of total hospital capacity exceeds 15%. Until such time as the trauma service area has 7 consecutive days in which the number of COVID-19 hospitalized patients as a percentage of total hospital capacity is 15% or less. For the past 7 days, the number of COVID-19 hospitalized patients in trauma service area J as a percentage of total hospital capacity exceeds 15%, making it an area with high hospitalizations as defined above. As a result, as of November 23, 2020, all restaurants, retail stores, office buildings, manufacturing facilities, gyms and exercise facilities and classes, museums and libraries in all counties in Trauma Service Area J are required to return to maximum 50% occupancy levels, except in any county that separately qualifies for the greater occupancy levels because it has minimal cases of COVID-19 under the Department of State Health Services attestation process. Trauma Service Area J includes the following counties: Andrews, Brewster, Crane, Ector, Glasscock, Howard, Jeff Davis, Loving, Martin, Milden, Pecos, Midland, Presidio, Reeves, Terrell, Upton, Ward, Winkler. Additionally, all licensed hospitals in the Trauma Service Area are required to discontinue elective surgeries as set forth in Executive Order GA-31. The Health and Human Services Commission, the agency responsible for regulating hospitals in Texas, is separately providing notice directly to affected hospitals, notifying them of the requirement to discontinue elective surgeries located in Trauma Service Area J. City approves $795,000 worth of equipment. By Nathan Hewer, Pioneer Editor. Before Stockton City Council decided to move forward with the purchase of 5 new pieces of equipment for the total cost of $795,136 at the group's regular meeting on November 10th, the city will receive a 2020 Peterbilt Model 348 dump truck, $133,995, 2020 Peterbilt Model 348 4,000-gallon water truck, $131,089.21, 2 2019 John Deere 410L backhoe loaders, $290,548.28, and a 2020 ED entire chip spread K7395, $290,548.28. In the early part of 2021, according to Fort Stockton City Manager Frank Rodriguez, the time frame is ideal for the city with plans in place to start work on streets in February. The new dump truck will be added to the city's stock of trucks that are currently older models. Public Works Director Aaron Ramos stated at the meeting via video conference call that they are essential pieces of equipment for street department work. A dump truck is one of the most essential pieces of equipment for street repairs. The new water truck will prove to be just as essential, if not more, due to the city having one currently, Ramos added. The city does only have one water truck, a 2010 model. It's split up between the street, landfill operations, pest control, and fire prevention. So we do need another water truck to help transport more water. The 2 backhoe loaders approved for purchase was a cost-effective move by the city after research by Rodriguez, Ramos, and Finance Director Maria Rodriguez, along with others. Mayor Chris Alexander spoke on the decision to go with 2 backhoe loaders instead of one larger piece of equipment. One of the areas we identified we're short on is backhoes, so if the water and street department are both having issues, guess where the backhoe goes? That's why we opted to go with the 2 units rather than the 1 bigger unit. Rodriguez also spoke on the research that took place and gave information on what exactly the backhoes will be used for. We had at least 3 meetings on those 2 pieces of equipment for 1. Originally, it was $119,000 for 1. The front-end loader was $298,000. After researching and talking to the vendor for the asphalt zipper, that it was allowable for the 410 to push the asphalt zipper to perform its functions. So we decided, based on the infrastructure and what we currently had and the pieces of equipment, we'd be able to benefit from these 2 backhoes. The new chip spreader will help save on long-term costs, preventing the need to hire private contractors and help the city become more efficient in their repairs. Previously, the city used to borrow the county's chip spreader, according to Ramos, and with the purchase of the new one, that will not be the case anymore, although they could work in unison to get work done twice as fast. Our current chip spreader needs a lot of work. It's a 1996 model. Every time we do simple projects here in the city for city streets, we had to borrow this type of equipment from the county. We'll have our own equipment and train our own operators so we can do a lot more. Rodriguez added, this is going to help tremendously to be able to spread the aggregate on the street and be able to shape it with other pieces of equipment. We will be able to cover more ground. The equipment will be paid year over a 7-year period of time via a loan through Citizens National Bank with a 1.17% interest rate. The loan, which is for the amount of $1,230,000 will accumulate $821,501 in interest over 7 years. The loan is considered to be part of the city's general fund after approval of the issuance and sale of City of Fort Stockton, Texas Tax Notes, Series 2020, levying an annual ad valorem tax and providing for the payment of said notes at the City Council meeting on November 10th. Additionally, the loan will be paid for by the city through sales tax, while property tax will be used as a collateral, according to Director of Finance, Maria Rodriguez. The sales tax will cover the city's payment throughout the loan. PCSB to sponsor Foster Child Giving Tree. Press release. Child Protective Services has joined efforts with the Pecos County State Bank in sponsoring the Foster Child Giving Tree this year. Paper ornaments with names of foster children from our area with their Christmas wishes are available at the Pecos County State Bank for you to pick up and spread the Christmas joy by shopping and providing the gift listed. Some of these wishes are for toys and others for clothing, but all will bring smiles to the faces of children who have experienced abuse and neglect in their young lives. The paper ornaments can be found in the lobby of the Pecos County State Bank in their Fort Stockton location beginning November 30th until December 13th, when the gifts are due back to the bank. Donors are asked to return the paper ornaments with the corresponding gifts in a gift bag or unwrapped to the bank. Please contact Kenda Bilardo at 432-336-1238 if you have any questions. Notice on Pecos County Pretrial by Joe Schuster, Pecos County Judge. Taking into consideration public health concerns arising from the novel coronavirus 19, the previously scheduled December 1st pretrial docket is postponed until further notice. You will be notified when a new hearing date is scheduled for your case. Your guide to local places to go and things to do. Friday, December 4th, the Season of Hope 2020 Christmas Parade will be held on Friday, December 4th at 6:30. Parade lineup begins at 5:30 p.m. on Rio Street. Contact the Chamber after 10 a.m. Friday, December 4th, to get your assigned lineup spot. Assignments are subject to change. Check in at line up to confirm. Please visit fortstockton.org/events to see COVID-19 guidelines and restrictions for the event. November 30th through December 11th, the annual silent auction of the 2020 Joy Run will be at the Chamber of Commerce in Fort Stockton from November 30th to December 11th during normal business hours. The 2020 Santa Hog Joy Run is scheduled for Friday, December 18th. The Joy Run delivers gifts to all the residents of our local nursing homes. Monetary donations as well as donations of items for sale in the auction are being accepted. Please consider making a donation of any amount. Every dollar helps. Auction items and donations may be sent or delivered to the Fort Stockton Chamber of Commerce. Please do not mail cash. December 10th through 13th, Fort Stockton Community Theater presents the children's music Christmas musical, The Littlest Angel, located at 102 South Nelson Street in Fort Stockton.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, November 26th. Deputies seek info on slaying of RCDC guard. The story was written by Rosie Flores, staff writer for the Pecos Enterprise. A guard at the Reeves County Detention Center was found dead Monday morning off a ranch road 25 miles northwest of Pecos, and Reeves County Sheriff's Department is seeking the public's help with information into what deputies said was a homicide. Miguel Angel Sanchez Jr., age 31, was found by an oil field worker passing by on FM 2119 in Reeves County around 10 a.m. Monday. The body was discovered near the intersection with Reeves County Road 232, about 10 miles southeast of the Reeves-Culberson County line, and the road was closed off to traffic on Monday during the initial part of the investigation. FM 2119 is mainly used by oil field traffic and ends at the former Pennzoil Duval sulfur mine in Culberson County. CR 232 connects the Toya and Orla areas in northern and western Reeves County and is mainly used by oil field traffic and area landowners. Reeves County Sheriff's investigators, Pecos Police investigators, and Texas Rangers are actively investigating. Quote, "Our initial assessment of the investigation has revealed that Sanchez's death will be a homicide," said Reeves County Chief Deputy Ernest Lascano. Sanchez was identified as a guard at the RCDC in Pecos. Deputies did not say how he was killed or if they could determine whether or not the homicide occurred at that isolated location or if Sanchez's body was left in that area after the homicide occurred at another site. An autopsy has been ordered, and Reeves County Sheriff's Office said that they will release further details in the near future as the investigation progresses. Quote, "Since this is an ongoing investigation, we cannot comment further at this time," Lascano said. If anyone has any information that may help Reeves County Sheriff's Office with the investigation, please contact the Criminal Investigation Division at 432-445-4901. Quote, "Reeves County Sheriff's Office would like to extend our most sincere condolences to the family and friends of the deceased and to Reeves County Detention Center in the loss of Major Sanchez," Lascano said in a statement. City cancels annual Christmas parade. The annual lighted Christmas parade has been canceled due to growing concerns over the recent spike in COVID-19 cases. According to City Manager Rex Thee, quote, "With the strong recommendation of the city due to the dramatic increase in active cases of COVID-19 in Monahans and Ward County, and concern about the hospitalization rate locally, the lighted Christmas parade has been canceled. Not only does the large gathering of spectators make social distancing impossible, but the groups that would interact closely while building floats is a concern," he added. Under the governor's order, with the increased cases, Ward County is now classified as having high hospitalizations, and elective surgeries are currently prohibited, bars are closed, businesses and restaurants are being limited to 50% capacity. Quote, "Unfortunately, canceling events like this has become necessary as community leaders and event organizers make decisions they hope helps improve the COVID situation and are in the best interest of citizens, friends, and families," they said. COVID issues causes delays in school renovation projects. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. In addition to the grievance hearing and public comment regarding the dress code policy at Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD, as reported in last week's edition of the news, the trustees addressed several other business matters in their November 16th meeting. The COVID-19 issues is also impacting construction and renovation projects within the district, architect R.J. Lopez of Park Hill Smith & Cooper told the trustees. Quote, "COVID issues have caused delays of about 3 weeks in renovation activities at Tatum Kindergarten, Tatum Elementary, and Walker Junior High. But crews will be back to work next week, November 23rd, Lopez said. In reporting progress at Monahans High School, the old pep rally gym, cafeteria, and shop have been demolished. The old auditorium and natatorium is still standing. The high school is mostly paperwork at this time, and permits are all good. The new bus barn is in design and will be ready for bids on November or January, Lopez said. Quote, "Bids came in a bit below estimates for the high school and renovation projects," he said. Construction of the new elementary school in the East Parkway area has not been impacted by COVID issues, as isolation has been maintained by equipment doing groundwork. Steel is expected in January, and footings will begin, depending on the weather. The trustees approved a guaranteed maximum price change order for Cullender, Tatum, and Walker Junior High to add additional access control devices at these three campuses. The additional devices will add $46,000 to Cullender, $51,000 to Tatum, and $118,000 to Walker. Quote, there is enough money in the project and construction contingency funds to cover the cost of these changes, and we still have about $150,000 left, Lopez said. Trustees present for the meeting were Bobby Almanza, Quint Melius, Donna Garcia, Raymond Reyes, Joel Greiner, Nancy Upchurch, and Steve Fine. Active corona cases continue to rise. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of active corona-19 cases continues to escalate in Ward County. As of Wednesday morning, there were 198 cases, up from 164 on Monday morning and 194 in the last 14 days. Since the start of the pandemic, there have been 373 total cases, with 171 recoveries and 4 deaths. Locally, 1,915 tests have been administered, with 31 pending. There has not been any additional deaths with the recent spike in cases. Ward County Commissioners, in their Monday meeting, set maximum attendance guidelines for county facilities. These smaller community centers are limited to a maximum of 25 people. The Coliseum is limited to 50 people, and the Event Center and Arena are limited to 200. Ward County Judge Greg Holly said, quote, "We're reaching the 14-day period following the onset of the local spike in reported cases. We had only 4 cases reported in the first 10 days of the month, and then the larger numbers began on November 11th with daily reports of 26, 11, 26, and so forth. We had 8 cases reported today, a welcome reduction of some of the numbers we've been seeing during the last couple of weeks," end quote. Governor Greg Abbott reinstated closing bars on Tuesday, and restaurants and retail are limited to 50% capacity. Statewide, there are currently 169,000 active cases, with 1,115,000 total cases and 20,000 deaths. Additionally, there have been 12.3 million cases with 257,000 deaths. Chevron opens new office in Monahans. The 11,690-square-foot facility will allow for expanded growth of the workforce in the region. Chevron recently finished construction on a 11,690-square-foot facility on Betty Avenue in Monahans. The new office will promote collaboration, improve employee experience, and provide opportunity for continued expansion in the region as the workforce grows. Inside the office, there is seated capacity for 58, including single offices, shared offices, open area workstations, and conference rooms, all equipped with wireless network access and upgraded audiovisual and video conferencing capabilities. To the side of the building is a 5,600-plus square foot maintenance building that will be used for parts storage and workshop. The construction was completed in less than 1 year and managed by Chevron's Environmental Management and Real Estate Company, with assistance from Monahans employees, and constructed by D.E. Harvey Builders. A small ribbon cutting was held on Wednesday, November 18th, and abided by COVID-19 protocols. There will be an opportunity for others to see the office once it is safe to do so. The larger field office is just one way Chevron is reinforcing its commitment to Monahans. Earlier this year, the company also provided a $50,000 investment to increase the broadband capability in the community and secured PPE donations for medical workers, schools, and first responders. Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, November 19th. Crash, high-speed chase nets illegals. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Ward County Sheriff's Office deputies, Monahans Volunteer Fire Department, and Texas Department of Public Safety troopers received a call of a one-vehicle rollover north of Piute on Friday around 10:42 p.m. Quote, "The rollover occurred 5 miles north of Piute on State Highway 115. Three subjects still inside the vehicle were injured, and a fourth individual was pinned beneath the van, Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle said. The original call stated approximately 8 juveniles fled from the crash scene on foot. Quote, through the course of the investigation, deputies learned it was actually 12 illegal aliens had fled the scene after crashing. Deputies tracked 4 sets of footprints for approximately 5 miles before losing the tracks in heavy brush, he added. None of the subjects who fled the crash scene was captured that night. The crash was investigated by Texas DPS. In a separate incident the next morning, around 8 a.m., sheriff's office deputies attempted to conduct a traffic stop on a Chevrolet Tahoe traveling eastbound on I-20 at approximately the mile mark at 68 for a traffic violation. Quote, the vehicle did not stop, and a pursuit ensued with speeds averaging around 90-plus miles per hour, Valle said. Texas Department of Public Safety troopers deployed spikes at approximately the mile marker 76, which were unsuccessful. Quote, after the first set of spikes failed, the vehicle continued east and exited at mile marker 77, where MPD units placed spikes for the second time, and the vehicle stopped prior to crossing the spikes, he added. The driver, identified as Luis Manuel Munoz, age 24, of Big Spring, was taken into custody at the Ward County Jail, along with 7 illegal aliens, nationalities from Mexico and Guatemala. Munoz was subsequently charged with evading arrest with a vehicle, a third-degree felony. The other 7 were transported to the Ward County Jail, where they were turned over to United States Border Patrol. Later Saturday morning, Ward County Sheriff's Office responded to 2 calls for service in reference to subjects dressed in black and camouflage at a ranch house north of Paiute along the Winkler-Ward County line on the Ward County side. Quote, responding deputies who assisted with the pursuit went to the ranch house where they took 3 Guatemala nationals into custody. It is presumed the subjects were part of the individuals who fled on foot from the crash on Friday night, Valle said. The 3 were transported to the Ward County Jail and were later turned over to United States Border Patrol. No more virtual learning. Monahans Wicked Paiute ISD has suspended virtual learning as of November 10th. District Superintendent Chad Smith told the trustees in Monday's meeting that, quote, kids in remote learning are failing miserably, not logging in, and not completing their work. This is not unique to Monahans. Other schools I have spoken with have described the same issues, end quote. A rumor was circulating on social media that the school would return to virtual learning because of the recent COVID-19 outbreak after the Thanksgiving break, November 23rd to 27th. Smith said, quote, that is not the case. All students will be back in class after the break, but we are keeping a close watch on the situation and will take action if needed, end quote. Council authorizes grant works to seek funding. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. At their regular meeting on Tuesday, November 10th, Monahan City Council authorized grant works to begin the process of seeking grants on behalf of the city related to the Community Development Block Grant Program. Quote, we've used them before as well as community block grants to put in water lines in the low to moderate income areas for water, sewer, housing, and other improvements. It is typically a good program and usually requires a match, City Manager Rex Thee said. Cities the size of Monahans find better success finding grants under the Texas Department of Agriculture. Quote, even though we authorize grant works to seek grants on our behalf, it is not limited to just them. This allows any who would like to submit a grant application to the city for our approval to do so, Thee said. According to HUD.gov, quote, the Texas Community Development Block Grant Program plays a critical role in helping smaller communities meet infrastructure needs in low to moderate income areas. Communities that are eligible for the tax CDBG funding are called non-entitlement communities, which are cities with populations under 50,000 and counties with populations under 200,000. They are called non-entitlement because entitlement areas are eligible for funding from the Federal Community Development Block Grant. End quote. This authorization is at no cost to the city. Along with Thee, Jeppy Wilson serves as Mayor Pro Tem in the absence of Mayor David Cutbirth. Council members present were Richard Hawkins, Calvin Carroll, and Ivy Valenzuela. Rudy Hernandez and City Attorney Alan Nicholas were not present. MEDC gets $1.5 million grant. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Faster internet may soon be making its way to Monahans. Board members of the Monahans Economic Development Corporation, the MEDC, learned on Monday they landed a $1.5 million federal grant for 13 miles of new fiber loop internet conduit to serve the commercial and industrial businesses in Monahans. MEDC met for their regularly scheduled meeting on Monday, where Carol Faulkner with Faulkner Consulting LLC told the group he had heard a response back on the original $3 million grant submitted to the U.S. Economic Development Administration Austin Office Investment Review Committee in September, quote, was approved for $1.5 million, and with local contributions in the amount of $600,000, they will have around $2.1 million to work with to help move the broadband project along, end quote. The total project cost was expected to be about $3 million, and the grant required 20% to come from local funds. Monahans Chamber of Commerce Director Teresa Burnett was essential in helping to secure additional contributions from the Permian Basin Foundation, the King Foundation, Ward County, as well as other contributors. Quote, the plan is to eventually extend the fiber out to residential customers, which is critical now considering the current pandemic and how many people are working and doing school from home, he added. In other actionable agenda items was board approval of a warranty deed in the amount of $22,000 for the roadwork completed by LOA Land Development and the construction of Monahans Parkway Phase 1. The warranty is good for 12 months and will cover any repairs to the road within that time frame. A warranty deed was suggested by Maverick Engineering Project Representative Dean Rasmussen and was not included in the original contract with LOA. The total cost to complete Phase 1 of Monahans Parkway was $907,000.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.